Hello and welcome to the Spike podcast. I'm Fraser Myers and with me today are Spike's deputy editor and host of the Last Orders podcast, Tom Slater.
Hello.
And Spike columnist Ella Whelan.
Hi.
This week on the Spike podcast, we discuss Trump's rhetoric, the return of blasphemy, and if vegans can take a joke.
Our president cannot escape special scrutiny.
Filling the airwaves with heated rhetoric, violent imagery, and conspiracy theories. People are listening, and worse, some are acting on what they hear.
Donald Trump used the name George Soros for the first time in his presidency, and the guy had a pipe bomb in his mailbox last night.
The media also has a responsibility to stop the constant false attacks.
The United States is still reeling from a week of terror. First, pipe bombs were sent to leading Democrats and prominent critics of Donald Trump. Then, in Pittsburgh, a gunman opened fire on the Tree of Life synagogue, killing 11. It's been dubbed the deadliest anti-Semitic attack in American history. Many saw one thing to blame for these horrific attacks: President Trump. He's accused of inciting violence with his angry, divisive rhetoric. But is it actually right to say Trump is inciting violence?
I don't think it is right to say that Trump is inciting violence, and I actually think it's a really dangerous road to go down. First of all, because you end up absolving the people of responsibility for these attacks or attempted attacks, whether it's Cesar Sayle, the guy who sent those 21 pipe bombs to various critics of Trump, or it's Robert Bowers, who committed, allegedly at this point, we should say, given the investigation is ongoing, that horrific slaughter at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. To suggest that Trump's rhetoric is to blame for those, I think, absolves them of responsibility. And I think it also gets into a very dangerous climate in which you're effectively calling heated political discussion a form of incitement. I mean, this is a point that Wendy Kaminer, no fan of Donald Trump, made on Spike this week, insofar as it's a very dangerous road to go down to suggest that the overheated rhetoric of Trump, his bluster, say, against the media, or as some would see it, his dislike of George Soros, feeding a kind of anti-Semitic feeling within the country, I think could very easily be used to chill discussion. And I think is actually being quite cynically used to just score points against Trump by some people who just never liked him in the first place. I understand that particularly in the case of the synagogue shooting, which was huge, horrendous, and incredibly unexpected. And I think there's a lot of people who are obviously very upset about that. But there's a lot of commentators, some of which in Britain, some of which across the world, who are just jumping on this, frankly, to score points against their favourite target. And that, to me, is incredibly grim. It doesn't get to the bottom of the problems of, say, anti-Semitism in America, what's driving that as it is around the world. It doesn't make us understand better why this pipe bomber was doing what he did. It's being used cynically, and I think people should be ashamed for doing that.
I mean, even on a level of the facts, it doesn't really hold up that Trump has been directly inciting people like Cesar Sayoc. I mean, in 2002, he was arrested for threatening to blow up a power utility company. So this is someone who is known to the police long before Trump came on the scene, is into explosives. And, you know, the fact that he lived in a van covered in Trump stickers and didn't like Democrats isn't a reason to then point the finger at Trump. You should be very careful about that. In relation to the synagogue shooting, I just want to read out what Dr. Jeffrey Cohen, who was the president at the general hospital that Robert Bowers was taken to, many of the victims of the shooting were taken to. He said, "I thought it was important to at least talk to him, Robert Bowers, and meet him. You can't on the one hand say that we should talk to each other and then I don't talk to him. You should lead by example and I'm the leader of the hospital." I just thought that was a really important and great thing to say amid all the discussion about how we should be clamping down on speech. You know, the protests against Trump when he went to eventually visited the synagogue were saying words matter, you're not welcome here, you need to speak out against white nationalism before you're allowed to come here. And for a Jewish doctor who had to treat and help the murderer, alleged murderer, of people in his community to defend speech at that moment, I think means that everyone else who is attacking it is a coward.
I think that's right. And on this question of anti-Semitism as well, there seems to be this sense from a lot of the commentary that anti-Semitism suddenly emerges out of the blue with the election of Trump. It's quite a bizarre take that really downplays, you know, the existing anti-Semitism in the US and particularly the growing anti-Semitism in Europe as well. The comedian Samantha Bee has labelled the following phrases as anti-Semitic dog whistles. She says that if you use the phrase globalist, if you use the phrase coastal elite or Hollywood liberals, then you are effectively, you know, dog whistling to anti-Semites. So it becomes quite clear that even the scourge of anti-Semitism is being used just to score points against Trump.
I mean, it certainly feels like that. And again, just to go back to the evidence that we have, if you think about Robert Bowers, he posted on Gab, this social media site, which is, because it has no controls on speech, has become, unfortunately, a bit of a meeting point for a lot of white supremacists and neo-Nazis, criticising Trump because he was giving too much role to, you know, the Jewish lobby. He has this Orthodox Jewish son-in-law, a Jewish daughter, very, very pro-Israel. And whilst you could potentially level criticism at Trump for maybe kind of feeding too much of that far-right trope, which is effectively that, you know, these global interests who all happen to be Jewish are kind of, you know, bringing immigrants in, etc., the extent to which Trump's discussion of the caravan, the Central American migrants who are heading for the border, is somehow being funded by Soros, etc., we can criticize that. But I think to suggest that he in and of himself is explicitly anti-Semitic and that he is causing these attacks, I think is incredibly short-sighted. Now, I get that in America, because they haven't experienced the kind of slaughter, frankly, of Jewish people on their soil that has been happening in Europe increasingly over recent years, that this has come as a bit of a shock. And I know that a lot of people are trying to look around for what the causes of this are. But I think the people who are really beneath contempt in this discussion are the kind of more international commentators, the people we see talking about this in Britain, the people we see talking about this generally, who are suddenly speaking in very damning terms about the rise of anti-Semitism allegedly spurred on by Trump, but have been almost entirely silent about some of the most horrific attacks we've seen recently across Europe. You know, this year, a Holocaust survivor was stabbed to death in Paris. We never talk about that. That was not international news for days and days and days. You know, the Jewish deli that was shot up in 2015 following the Charlie Hebdo attack, the attack on the synagogue in Copenhagen, and also one of the standout cases, which Brendan O'Neill, our editor, wrote about this week, was the Toulouse shooting in 2012, where a French Algerian Islamist, effectively, as part of a broader rampage, rolled up at a Jewish school in Toulouse, opened fire on the playground, killed a rabbi and his two sons, then grabbed an 8-year-old girl by the hair and shot her point blank range. We don't talk about those cases. Mm-hmm. And I think the extent to which it feels like, because those cases are, for whatever reason, more touchy to talk about, they often involve Islamists. And so that's always a far more difficult discussion for some people for some reason. To now hop on this issue, to pretend like they care about it deeply, given the fact that you mentioned those cases to some of these people and they probably wouldn't even have heard of them, I think speaks volumes about a lot of the hypocrisy in this discussion.
Let's go back to this free speech question, the question of Trump's rhetoric.
Look, I've been thinking about this, and while we're absolutely right to denounce the, frankly, the idiots who seem to be wanting to directly link Trump with the actions of these deranged individuals, which I think any sensible person would see is not a sensible thing to do. On the other hand, the kind of the tenor of the discussion about free speech in America and also over here in the UK is giving rise to some kind of quite an ugly situation. So I think people don't realize the more that they call for speech to be censored and the more they say that these kind of views should be driven underground, shouldn't be allowed to see the light of day, the more credence and glamorization and importance you give to these kind of nutballs. Having said that, it's important to note that President Trump himself is also a complete travesty when it comes to defending free speech.
Yeah, I think it's really true in this question of civility, you know, whether we should tone down the language. It's really clear that absolutely everyone can play that game. It's not just the liberals calling on Trump to tone down the language. It's also Trump calling on the press to be quiet, stop criticizing him. So, you know, there's no real winner in this. Now, some Democrats have said they don't want to be civil. Hillary Clinton says you cannot be civil with a party that wants to destroy what you stand for. And Nancy Pelosi promised she'd turn down the rhetoric when we win the midterms. So there is this kind of sense that it's okay for one side to be uncivil, it's not okay for the other, when actually, you know, we should have free speech across the board.
Exactly.
People can be as inflammatory as they like.
Yeah, and this can cut both ways. I mean, it was only last year that Republican Congressman Steve Scalise was shot at a baseball game by a Bernie Sanders supporter. And everyone on the right jumped on that and said, effectively, you know, they're stirring up hatred against Trump and Republicans, and what do you expect with all of this overheated rhetoric? So it's so easily used by the other side. But just to sort of bolt on to a point that Ella made, what's really interesting and concerning is this discussion, particularly amongst US liberals, quote unquote, about social media's role in all of this, because there's obviously been a kind of quite sustained campaign to kick a lot of not just fascistic or neo-Nazi, but kind of right-wing, hard-right conspiratorial people off of sites like Facebook, off of YouTube, off of all of these different platforms. And now a lot of this concern about Gab, which, as we've heard about a lot in recent days, has become, frankly, from what it seems, a bit of a cesspit, given the fact that they have no controls and it's probably one of the only places on the internet a lot of these scumbags can congregate. But the thing that just strikes me is the fact that, take someone like Robert Bowers, who existed entirely, by the sounds of it, was a complete loner, spent all of his time on this social media platform. He was pushed into that echo chamber, if you like, by the fact there was nowhere else for it to go. Now, am I saying that he was just a sort of lost sheep who, if he'd have been submitted to robust criticism on Twitter, he might not have done it? Of course not. It's a ridiculous thing to suggest. But on the broader scope, insofar as not, as Ella would said, glamorising these views, and also just giving people more and more licence to feel like they are these kind of rebels, etc., I think this discussion is going completely the wrong way. They're saying we need to shut down more places on the internet rather than opening it up more broadly. And the thing that it also comes down to is, when you're having this discussion, it's not just those extreme views that get caught in the crossfire. It's going to be everyone. And it's just worrying that in, you know, America, the land of the First Amendment, so many people seem so cavalier about giving some of those freedoms
away. I mean, the last point to make in it also is, where does this end? I mean, I was listening to the Today programme, and there was a section on the Lewes bonfire, which, anyone who doesn't know, is a tradition in Lewes in Sussex, where they blow up and set fire to effigies of prominent political figures and controversial figures. And this year they're going to blow up Boris Johnson. And John Humphreys said, don't you think today, in the climate at which there's a lot of criticism for people using extreme language against politicians and the dangers of that, don't you think this is wrong? And the two representatives of Lewes laughed at him, thankfully. But I mean, if you get into a situation in which you cannot even light up a joke effigy of a politician for fear of it causing what, violence against Boris Johnson, I mean, that's the ridiculous place that this discussion ends.
You're listening to The Spike Podcast. If you're enjoying the show, why not give us a rating and a review? It really helps new listeners find the show. Up next, blasphemy. Asia Bibi, a Christian mother of three, had spent 8 years on death row thanks to Pakistan's draconian blasphemy laws. This week, she was acquitted by Pakistan's Supreme Court. Meanwhile, in Europe, Ireland voted overwhelmingly to scrap its constitutional ban on blasphemy. But in the same week, the European Court of Human Rights decreed that an Austrian woman could lawfully be convicted for calling Muhammad a paedophile. First up, let's stick with Pakistan. Asia Bibi has been acquitted, but this isn't the end of blasphemy convictions by any means for that country, is it?
Certainly not. I mean, one of the horrifying things about that entire case is that, in fact, it sort of brings to light how not only are these laws wrong on the face of it and can be incredibly brutal. You know, she spent 8 years in prison. Large parts of it in solitary confinement in Lord knows what conditions. And the thing, what's incredibly kind of horrendous about it, is it basically breaks down to a spat that happened between herself, who's a Pakistani Christian, and other women over, you know, her supposedly contaminating something they were working with, and then her allegedly saying something about the Prophet. And the more you read about it, the more ways these laws are actually weaponized in these really kind of spiteful and ultimately kind of barbarous fashion to sort of clamp down on people is really absolutely horrendous. But I think there's a hell of a lot of Western hypocrisy on this issue, given the fact that, of course, you know, Ireland has just voted by a huge margin, I think it was like 65-35, to repeal its very old blasphemy law. But at the very same time, the very same groups who are campaigning to have that overturned, like Amnesty Ireland, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties, in the same press release, in the case of the latter, said that we've repealed blasphemy, but free speech is not absolute, and we need to introduce greater hate speech legislation. We also saw, you know, just days before that, the European Court of Human Rights rule that an Austrian woman was right to be prosecuted in Austria for calling Muhammad a paedophile. And there's a hell of a lot of hypocrisy here. And I think what's interesting is the fact that the kind of idea of blasphemy is treated in some Western circles as something which is to almost like sneer at. It's something that backward countries like Ireland have, where they're full of all these kind of like mad backward-looking Catholics who are just clinging onto their Bibles. And yet there are all these kind of new blasphemies, you know, things to protect from hate speech, or increasingly blasphemy laws which seem to be almost, you know, routinely used to protect Islam from criticism in various European countries. And I think it just gets down to the fact that the kind of authoritarian, almost theocratic censorship that a lot of people in the West like to pretend we left behind is something that is still very much alive and well in different forms. And one thing just finally that was quite striking and interesting, a bit of a historical irony, was the fact that Asia Bibi was actually convicted under laws which were enacted by the British Raj in 1860.
Wow.
Which were later kind of gold-plated by the military dictatorship in the 80s. So it just goes to show that the idea that blasphemy, that this kind of authoritarian belief that you should just clamp down on dissidents of whatever stripe, is something that we've left behind and is just something that the backward peoples of the world cling on to. I think this kind of constellation of stories we've seen recently have sort of shown what a crock that is.
Yeah, and some examples of the blasphemies being committed in Europe that have ended up with people charged with crimes or being detained. We had the YouTuber and right-wing activist Lauren Southern was detained under anti-terror laws, prevented from entering the UK because she was handing out a leaflet that said Allah is gay. There was a man in Austria just a year before this case of the woman calling Mohammed a paedophile who basically had been arrested for yodeling, and his neighbours overheard his yodeling while he was mowing his lawns and they mistook it as mocking the call to prayer, and that went to court. And he was issued, you know, a massive fine. These kinds of things can happen all the time. And you know, this is supposedly in enlightened Europe.
Yeah, supposedly. And if you rewind back 20 years, I can remember Father Ted, the much-loved comedy show, which not only was blasphemous, but used to regularly joke about priests being paedophiles, regularly joke about priests being gay and you know, having an affairs and doing all kinds of horrendous blasphemous stuff. And it was a riot and everyone loved it. That was taking the mick out of Catholicism. Today it seems that the one religion that you really, really can't be blasphemous about is Islam. And importantly, in Pakistan, even though Asia Bibi is potentially going to be let go, there are armed guards having to basically protect where the Supreme Court is in Islamabad because there are semi-murderous riots trying to get at her. Mm. And Punjab Governor Salman Taseer, who was murdered for speaking out in support of her, his murderer is seen as a kind of martyr and is celebrated. So, you know, you've got these incredibly backward views of religion and backward beliefs that are not being challenged, and that same sort of backward idea of the idea that you should be killed for being blasphemous is being echoed, not with the same murderous intent but with the same seriousness, in supposedly enlightened secular societies in Europe. And if you're not able to sort of draw a link between them, then you're sort of being blind about the seriousness of this.
Well, the Pakistani government have said explicitly that they welcomed the European Court's ruling, and they have said also that they use European human rights thinking in their use, in their application of blasphemy law. Obviously, they ignore the bits that we have against the death penalty and all the other human rights issues. But the fact is that these give a green light to authoritarian, oppressive regimes.
And they use it all the time. If you think about recently, the kind of relationship between Western, quote-unquote, liberal authoritarianism, if you will, and kind of, you know, Middle Eastern, you know, Islamist authoritarianism, as you might put it, they're constantly in conversation with one another. If you think in recent years, there's been all of this hysteria in America, Britain, Europe, about, say, something like fake news. Mm. There have been countries around the world which have used exactly the same rhetoric to clamp down on their own critics. You know, they take the language of the supposedly free world and their own and our own kind of hypocrisies and blind spots in relation to that and use it to justify their own ends. And I think the other thing that you've nodded to, Fraser, is just how feeble and actually counterproductive human rights legislation is in relation to any of this stuff. So, I mean, as everyone talks about, Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights supposedly enshrines our rights to free speech and free thought. But there are so many qualifications which are applied to it, ranging from everything from in the interests of national security, as well as the protection of public health and morals, you know. And I think what we really need to recognise is not only do we need to be more principled in our fight for freedom of speech, but also we can't outsource it to these kind of international human rights groups, lawyers, lobbyists, etc., because they don't really believe in free speech either. And it seems like the fight for it is far more profound than some people would like to pretend.
You're listening to the Spiked podcast. Spiked has no paywalls and no subscriptions. It's contributions from listeners and readers like you that keeps us fighting for freedom and democracy. If you'd like to support Spiked, just go to spiked-online.com and hit the donate button. Up next, vegans. Magazine editor William Sitwell was hounded from his job following the leak of a private email in which he joked about killing vegans. We know vegans are a sensitive bunch, but what's their beef this time?
William Sitwell is an utter moron because if you are the editor of a magazine sending an email to a journalist and you're the editor of a magazine which is making a lot of its money off of the whole vegan fascination, then you're an idiot for doing that. And I think it's part of this argument is about what makes good business. However, it was a joke sent in a private capacity, and he is, like him or lump him, someone who's worked at that magazine for 20 years. So the idea that he can be ousted, despite his experience, despite his expertise, for a stupid and obviously not serious joke, shows the kind of humorlessness of this particular community, if you can call them, in society. I mean, humorlessness is central to being vegan, it seems, but you just cannot accept not only any criticism but any poking of fun at you and your lifestyle.
I think in a way the biggest mistake he said was saying that to a vegan, as we say. You know, if he said it to anyone else, it probably would have been fine. I mean, we should probably say, for the sake of being specific, that it was a kind of vegan freelance journalist who was pitching on vegan issues, to which he said, how about a feature on, you know, killing all vegans and all the rest of it, just for a little bit of context. So it's not big, it's not particularly clever, and there is, you know, you could say that this is a slightly bizarre and niche spat, the kind of most bourgeois you've ever seen. It's like kind of a vegan Twitter mob on one side and the Waitrose magazine editorial board on the other. But it is actually quite important because this sits in a bit of a pattern, you know, insofar as there's been a number of cases in recent years where someone has been hauled over the coals, made to step down from various positions for making a joke, you know. I mean, this, if we think about Sir Tim Hunt in 2015, he made a joke about women scientists at a conference in South Korea in a speech, it should be noted, which was largely very pro-women scientists. One person took offence, kind of misquoted what he said, and then he was forced to step down from a number of positions. We saw it with the Toby Young situation, where, again, his old tweets, during which time he was just a more unabashed provocateur on Twitter, were used to make him step down from a position at a government regulator. And whilst we could always try and pass these cases individually, and we could split hairs about was it a private capacity or a public capacity, he was talking to someone who was a freelancer, etc., 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 you can't deny the pattern, which is to say that there is this really nefarious relationship going on between small, very vocal, very intolerant groups, whether they're vegan or anything else, who seem to be able to get quite large companies over a barrel just by nature of how loud they're shouting, you know. And there's something about that which is just really bad for all of us. And I think the other thing is that even though some of those cases I've mentioned, you know, the Toby Young case in particular, it was a lot of kind of people on the left who were really kind of piling in on that. As soon as you create this weapon, it's going to be used both ways for people who you might like. You know, the James Gunn case from recently, the director of the Guardians of the Galaxy series, who, again, was a vehement anti-Trumper, so loads of Trumpists went and found some jokes he'd made on Twitter and used them to get him sacked. It's just a really sad state of affairs when it feels like people are being this joyless and this censorious that we can't even just let these things slide, and they suddenly become these huge kind of, you know, culture war battles.
There are also some vegan-specific examples, aren't there, Tom, of chefs being fired?
I think that's another important point, actually, is the fact that whilst, you know, we're talking about someone like William Sitwell, he'll find another job. He's an old Etonian, very well connected. All the people coming out in support of him, you get a sense of what part of society he's from. But there are people further down the scale who have actually, and I was shocked to find this when I was researching for a piece I wrote on this, who have been targeted by vegans quite mercilessly, it turns out. So there was a case in 2016 where there was a head chef at a hotel in Derby who was on Instagram having an argument with a kind of militant vegan, made a joke about how he likes to kind of spike vegan customers' food with meat. They found out where he worked, bombarded the website with kind of fake one-star reviews, and he lost his job over it. And there was an almost exactly the same case this year with the co-owner of a restaurant in Shropshire. And in these instances, you know, they hadn't actually done anything wrong, and yet people are so willing to give in to the outrage of a group of people who, let's face it, in their kind of organised activist form, are incredibly shrill and intolerant. So it's the thing that we should be concerned about is if, for instance, someone like to Tim Hunt, a Nobel laureate, or William Sitwell, a very well-connected old Etonian magazine editor, if they can be targeted by this stuff, other people can too.
Ella, 600,000 vegans in the UK. Should they be a protected minority?
Oh, please.
They seem to think they are, or they should be.
Well, we've just spent, 10 minutes talking about blasphemy, and it's like, you know, say anything against vegans, you are blaspheming. I mean, it's not even I find it hard to even call it a lifestyle or a belief. It just means that you don't eat animal products. Yeah, it's a diet. I mean, it's the most uninteresting thing. I have yet to meet a vegan who has actually anything worthwhile to say other than
they believe it is very interesting,
wanting to celebrate themselves because they, you know, haven't eaten an egg this morning. But also they have, you know, fine, whatever your choices are at Spiked, we think people should be free to do whatever they want. However, don't make me care about it, and certainly don't try and get people sacked off the back of it. I think that, you know, whatever we think about William Sitwell, that journalist should feel pretty ashamed of herself for using that private correspondence to get someone sacked. It doesn't matter if he's a bajillionaire, whatever he is, that is pretty despicable.
You've been listening to the Spiked podcast. If you've enjoyed the podcast, why not give us a rating, a review, or even a donation? For more Spiked content, go to spiked-online.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.